Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September the 8th, 1995. In a Creekside room this evening, our speaker is Cedric Broughton, and he will be speaking on Palestine, Islamic Period, and Crusade. Let's listen in on Cedric Broughton.
What do I have to say? Oh. My name is Cedric Broughton, and this is The History of the Land of Palestine, the Islamic Period, and the Crusades, but also a tour of Palestine with slides. So those of you on tape won't get to see that, I guess. Before I get to that, let me push again, for the sake of our bookstore, two books that are in the bookstore that I think are worth getting. There's four copies, or at least this afternoon there were four copies of this book left. It's called The Land and the Book by Charles Page and Carl Voles, published by Abington. And Carl Voles is professor of church history at Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary. So he's a good Lutheran, I guess.
Worse than that, he's ex-Missouri, just like I am.
Oh, do you know him?
Yeah, he's my colleague.
Oh, okay.
Dear God.
Well, this book, the first half of this book is a historical overview of what has happened in the land of Palestine. And the second half of the book is descriptions of various sites that are in the land of Palestine that are mentioned in the Bible and a few that aren't mentioned in the Bible. And it tells you what happened at that site and what went on in the Mount of Olives, the Garden of Gethsemane, the churches that are built in that site, it mentions, and that sort of thing. So if you've never been to Palestine, or even if you have, and you're going again like Bill and Lori, and they want to brush up on what they're going to see, this is an excellent book to do that with. The other book that's in the bookstore, there are lots of books out about what is happening in the state of Israel in the 20th century, and lots of different viewpoints are expressed. This one is just one that I picked up probably 2 years ago now. Who are God's people in the Middle East? What Christians are not being told about Israel and the Palestinians? And this book is written by an evangelical Christian who teaches at Wheaton College, but he talks a lot about the Palestinians and what he has seen about Palestinians and the plight of Palestinians in the Holy Land. And it's a very well-reasoned and balanced viewpoint of things, particularly because it comes from an author who probably buys in, at least in part, to Hal Lindsey type of view of the state of Israel being coming into existence in 1948, presaging the second coming of Christ. But he also talks about, come on in, he also talks about what has happened, and I'm going to talk a little bit tomorrow in my session about, in general, about some things that he mentions. Up on the board, I'm not a great writer, so maybe you can't see that very well. But before I show the slides, I'd like to put the history in a bit of perspective. Should I take this with me? The history of Palestine in a bit of perspective, in part so that when you see the slides that you can fit some of the pictures you see into the historical framework. Starting in 70 AD or CE, CE is the secular historian's common era terminology. AD is traditionally how we date things. So 70 AD, Titus, you know that name, anybody? If you were in my last class, Titus was the son of the Roman Emperor Vespasian, and he finished off what his dad started, and that is quelling the uprising in Palestine that had come in the middle part of the first century. You've heard of the Zealots, probably, and you know the Jews rebelled, and there was a lot of fighting going on, and eventually Titus breached the walls of Jerusalem and overcame the city. The temple was burned down. The walls, for the most part, were torn down. and the city was pretty well defeated. Couple parts of the city, which I'll show you the slides, weren't torn down, remained from the Herodian era, but most of the city was torn down. Then there was a city of sorts built on that spot in Jerusalem, rebuilt again. Then along about 132-35, there was called the Bar Kokhba rebuilt. Who was it? Bar Kokhba was a Jew, and he led the final Jewish uprising against the Roman Empire. It was, of course, put down by the Romans. And in 135 AD, the Romans built a new city on the spot of Jerusalem, and they named it the, how do we pronounce that? Aelia Capitolina. That city, built by Emperor Hadrian, one of the interesting facts about that city was that he built a temple to Jupiter over the spot that the Christians had been saying was the spot where Christ was crucified and resurrected. He built a temple to Jupiter. And later on, under Constantine, that temple was raised, and the original Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built in that spot. Which brings us to Constantine. In 326, Helena, who is Constantine's mother, got a commission from her son to go to Palestine, and she apparently converted to Christianity. She went to Palestine, and in Palestine she built three churches. Does anybody know what they are? The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Jesus Christ was crucified, or the spot where they believe where Jesus Christ was crucified and was buried, is one of them. The Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, over the spot where Christ was born, and then the Church of the Ascension on the Mount of Olives, where Christ ascended to heaven. So Constantine's mother built three churches there. How many of you knew that? New information. Well, the land of Palestine remained under Christian Byzantine control. The Byzantine Empire, do you know what that's named for? With Constantine, the shifting of the focus of the empire went from Rome to what is today Istanbul, what was Constantinople under Constantine. So that empire held sway in the land of Palestine until 614. In 614, the Persians sacked Jerusalem and destroyed all the churches, Christian churches in the land except one. You know which one they didn't destroy? You remember, Bill?
No, I honestly don't.
They didn't destroy the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem because, the story goes, on the walls of that, inside of that church, there was a picture of Persians bringing gifts to the Christ child.
Oh, sure.
And so, so because they saw these men in Persian dress on the wall, they didn't destroy that church. But all the others, including the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Church of the Ascension, all the others were destroyed. The Persians were followers of the Zoroaster, however you pronounce it, religion.
Zoroaster.
Thank you, Bill. I put down the dates of Muhammad's life, 570 to 632. Muhammad was the founder of the religion Islam. And with Muhammad and with the founding of the religion Islam, there came to be a new force in the world that has affected us to this day in terms of their presence. In 638, Caliph Omar captured Jerusalem. He was a Muslim, of course. He captured Jerusalem. One of the interesting things he found out when he captured Jerusalem is that the Temple Mount area, where the Solomon's Temple had been, Herod's Temple had been, that was a garbage dump. The Christians were using it as a garbage dump because it was one way of showing how they despised the Jews. Omar was kind of shocked at this. He had it cleaned up, and he had a mosque built there. The Dome of the Rock was built in 691 on that spot. It still exists today. A little bit after that, the other mosque, the El Aqsa Mosque was built right next to the Dome of the Rock. So the Muslims have control of the land of Palestine. Now, the Muslims are no more monolithic in their theology and in their political persuasions than Christians or any other group of people are in the world. They fought each other as well as the rest of us have fought each other. And so there have been competing Arab empires down through the centuries, sometimes based in Syria and Damascus, some of them based in Egypt, and a few others based elsewhere. So there have always been this kind of competition between the variety of Arab empires. In 1071, the Seljuk Turks controlled Palestine, and they captured the Byzantine emperor. Now, this is very important because some of you are probably know about the Crusades and are fascinated about the Crusades. When the Seljuk Turks captured the Byzantine emperor, they stopped pilgrimage to the Holy Land by the Jews and the Christians, and they also he got released, but the Byzantine emperor said, "We need help. We can't do it on our own. We can't fight the Muslims on our own." So he appealed to the Pope in Rome for help. That's how the First Crusade got started. Okay? The First Crusade was an appeal by the Byzantine Empire to the Western Empire, to the Pope, come help us. And the Pope, Urban II, preached this sermon in which the cry went up, "God wills it that we should go and we should capture the Holy Land and help the Byzantine Empire." Now, one of the things that the Muslims had done that was a tactical error in some ways was that they had destroyed the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which had been rebuilt again. And that helped to bring the hue and the cry of the Christians in Europe saying, "We've got to go back to the Holy Land and we've got to take it out of the hands of the Muslims because they've destroyed the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, our holy shrine." So that was the first crusade. Oddly enough, the First Crusade was really the only real successful one. There were lots of crusades, and I forgot to bring this over to you. If you want to know about the crusades, there's lots of books you could read, but there's a way to do it that's much simpler than reading great big thick book. You ever heard of Christian History Magazine? It's a good magazine, and this magazine has an issue on the Crusades. Now, this is an issue that's some years old, but they do still have back orders. You can order this still. At least the last issue of the magazine I got, they still had this on back order. So you can get this issue. But this Christian History Magazine explains in a short summary all about the Crusades. And it's really worth getting. There's all kinds of interesting facts that go along with it. Did you know there were women in the Crusades? Women fought in the Crusades, participated in it. There were children's Crusades. The Muslims conquered far larger territories of Christians and vice versa. And as late as 1683, Muslim forces had pushed into Central Europe. Crusades were outrageously expensive. King Louis IX of France spent more than six times his annual income to finance one crusade. Richard the Lionhearted, you've all seen Robin Hood. Richard the Lionhearted was king of England for about 10 years, but he only spent about 6 months there because he was off on the crusades the rest of the time. This also has an interesting article by a historian named Jonathan Riley Smith that deals with the issue of holy violence and some of his perspectives on it. One of the things that he says, and maybe you think he's equivocating or not, but this is an interesting point. It's often said that Christians were more cruel than Muslims, for example, when they captured a city. Do you think that's true? And he responds, "I don't think it is. The case that is always given is this. When the Christians took Jerusalem in 1099, they mercilessly sacked the city, killing nearly everyone. But when the Muslims under Saladin captured Jerusalem in 1187, they allowed captives to go free. But that example accords with the medieval laws of war. If a city surrenders, you don't sack it. If it resists, you do. Jerusalem resisted in 1099 and it was sacked. When it surrendered in 1187, it was not. In actuality, you find cruelty on both sides, he says. So there's a lot of good stuff in this that magazine if you want to read up on the Crusades. When they captured Jerusalem in 1099, that was the beginning of the Latin kingdom that lasted until 1187 in Jerusalem. That is, Jerusalem was under Christian control to 1187. That's really not a long period of time, 88 years. But in those 88 years, they did a lot of building. So that when you go to Jerusalem today, and you'll see in the slides I'm going to show, a lot of the buildings that are there, the churches, etc., are at least in their foundations, and some of them, and quite a bit of their structure, from the Crusader times. There was still Christians in the land of Palestine until 1291, when the city of Acre, north of Haifa, present-day Haifa, I'm not sure, Acre might even be, is that in Lebanon? I'm not sure whether that's in Lebanon or whether that's in Israel. But anyway, that city was they were finally driven out of that city, and that ended the Christian presence in terms of having a governmental presence there in 1291. Early 13th century, the Jews were welcomed back to the city by the Muslims because the Crusaders hadn't welcomed them to the city of Jerusalem. But in the early 13th century, one of the Arabs had the walls of Jerusalem torn down. 1250 to 1517, the Mamluks of Egypt were in control of the land of Palestine, and some of the structures that you see on the Temple Mount today were improved or built by this group of Muslims. Then in 1331, the Franciscans came into the Holy Land, and in 1332, the Pope gave the Franciscans the official charge of protecting, guarding the Christian holy sites in Palestine, in Israel. And so that is why today, if you go to Israel and you go to the churches and you see that so many of the churches are run by the Franciscan order, it dates all the way back to the 1330s when the Pope said to the Franciscans, you are the ones who are going to protect and take care of our holy sites. So that's really interesting to me. St. Francis of Assisi, by the way, on one of the Crusades, I forget which one it was, but on one of the Crusades, he went along, and when they were in this kind of battle mode down in Egypt, he went across the lines and tried to convert the Sultan. Now, the Sultan didn't get converted, but he was so impressed with St. Francis that he wanted to give him money, wanted to give him riches. St. Francis refused, but then the Sultan gave St. Francis safe passage back to the Christian side of the line. So that's a little anecdotal in history. From 1517 to 1917, the Ottomans, the Ottoman Empire, which you probably all have heard about, centered in Turkey, had control of Palestine, and most scholars, historians, even Muslims don't think the Ottoman Empire was too hot a deal in their stewardship of the land of Palestine, but that's another story. The important date, 1537 to 1541, Suleiman the Magnificent built He built the walls of Jerusalem that basically we see today. So that when you go and you walk around the wall of Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem today, you're walking around walls that were built 1537 to 41 by Suleiman the Magnificent. Now, a lot of the walls were built on walls that were already there, you know, or that had been knocked down. But he's the one, the walls that you walk on now are ones that he built. Any questions before I get to the slides? I know that was really fast. any questions?
I did have one earlier on. When the Persians conquered there, who did they conquer in 614?
They conquered the Byzantine Empire. The Christians that were centered in Byzantium, who had control of that area. Any other questions? Okay. For how many of you is this new material? Most of you? Some of you? Yeah, okay.
I get the lights.
This is the city of Tel Aviv. So that when you fly into Israel, you fly into the Ben Gurion Airport, which is outside of Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is roughly in the spot of Old Joppa, Old Testament Joppa. And it is a large, large city. It's a modern city. And of course, Tel Aviv is where the Zionists who ultimately triumphed in 1948 were centered initially. Welcome to Israel. We traveled around Israel in those buses. They took care of about 50 people with a Jewish guide, and my bus had a Palestinian driver and a Jewish guide. Those are Mercedes-Benz buses. this is Tiberias. The city of Tiberias, which of course has the modern hotel today, was built by Herod Antipas, who was the son of Herod the Great, and he made it his capital. And it was the capital of Galilee during the time when Jesus was an adult. Actually, the present-day city of Tiberias is a few miles up north the Sea of Galilee from ancient Tiberias. But one of the reasons I don't know if just to the left of the hotel there, you see that structure, that building there just to the left? That's a Crusader building. There it is. See, there's structures right next to the modern is the ancient, and that is from the Crusader period. This is looking out over the Sea of Galilee. One of the things that struck me when I was in Israel is how small the Sea of Galilee is compared to a lot of the lakes and seas that we have today here in, like, Lake Chelan. The Sea of Galilee is pretty small. When I was there, the first several days I was there, it was calm. It was very calm on the Sea of Galilee, and I did a bad thing. I prayed to God to make it rough so that I could see what it would be like when it was stormy, you know, like when Jesus... And so the day we left Tiberias, it came up a storm on the lake, and I'm sure the folks who went out on boats that day didn't appreciate my prayers, but... you see across the way, that's the Golan Heights. And of course, in Jesus' day, or the Golan Heights in that area, that's on the Greek side, the city of the Decapolis side of the Sea of Galilee. There's another picture of modern Tiberias. You see that the topography of the land is hills. Galilee is very hilly. It's not mountainous in quite the way we're mountainous here, but it is hilly. Some of you know John Peterson, the program director of Holden Village. Well, John and I went to Israel together.
Does he have the Coke concession for Israel?
No. No. But I was surprised at how prevalent products from America are in Israel. You can I walked down the street and went into a bookstore and into a toy store, and the same things I would see in a bookstore and a toy store in a mall in the United States were there in those stores in Tiberias. That's how we went out on the Sea of Galilee on that boat, which is owned by a kibbutz, one of their businesses. You can still see them fish on the Sea of Galilee in boats that are very similar, they say, to the boats that that were around in Jesus' day. Of course, in Jesus' day, they didn't have outboard motors on them. But the manner of fishing and the size of boats is pretty similar. One of the ways you can tell that is back in the 80s, they found when the level of the Sea of Galilee dropped a bit one year, they found in the mud a boat that was encased in the mud, and they dug it out. You can see them carefully digging it out. They dated this boat back to the first century. When the Roman legions destroyed when they defeated the Jews, one of the places they destroyed was Magdala. Magdala on the Sea of Galilee, of course, that's where Mary Magdalene came from, was a city that had, I think, around 200. They said there were around 200 boats that were. And so this might have been even from that. They put this, I don't know what it is, styrofoam or something like that, around the boat to encase the boat in it, and took it out of the mud and onto the water, and they put it in to a museum there, and they are... It's submerged in water, and they're trying to bring it back so that it won't disintegrate. Trying to make the boat into a museum piece that isn't falling apart. This is again a Franciscan church. This is the Mount of Beatitudes, so-called Mount of Beatitudes. A church commemorating place where Jesus did the Sermon on the Mount, and you see how it looks out over the Sea of Galilee. Galilee is a beautiful area of Israel. It's to my way of thinking far more beautiful than down south where Jerusalem is. There's a close up of the church. This church was built in this century. I forget the exact date, but it was built. Since the British Mandate period. Now, this is where they suppose is the site of ancient Magdala. It's hard for me to envision that there was a city of, according to Josephus, I think, maybe 30,000 people right there, but that's what Josephus gives as a figure, right on the sea. Chorazim is up the hill from Capernaum, and it's not right on the water. It's up the hill, and it is now a national park. Chorazim was destroyed by an earthquake in, I think, the 7th century. There are remnants of the city, though, that they have excavated. That's the synagogue that was in Chorazim. Do you remember anything about that city? Anything Jesus said?
Woe to you, Capernaum.
Yeah. Capernaum, Chorazim, and
Bethsaida.
Jesus predicted the destruction. because they wouldn't repent and wouldn't follow him, even though he was right there amongst them. And here is the town of Jesus, which is again controlled by an order of the Catholic Church. And there's ancient Capernaum. Bill mentioned in his Bible study the other morning about the house of Peter, and there's a church built over that site. Actually, there's a modern church built over what they believed was an ancient church, the site of Capernaum. In the background there is the synagogue, and in the foreground is houses. There's inside the synagogue in Capernaum. This synagogue doesn't date from Jesus's day era. It's somewhat later, maybe the 3rd century. You cannot go and be baptized, or at least when I was there a year and a half ago, you couldn't go and be baptized in the place where they believed Jesus was baptized on the Jordan River, because that was part of the sort of the battle line area between Jordan and Israel. Now with the new peace treaties, I don't know how much that has changed. But just south of the Sea of Galilee on the Jordan River, one of the kibbutzes has a spot where modern-day pilgrims can go and be baptized. And that's the spot. So if you want to get baptized, some of the people who didn't get baptized took empty water jugs and filled it up with water from the Jordan River and took it back home to the United States, where one of them told me it turns black. They've got a nice setup to be baptized at. This is the young woman, Bill, that I was telling you about. She was working at this site, a young Jewish woman. What was interesting talking with her is she's Jewish, but she was born and raised in England, and she came to Israel to work on a kibbutz for a year and decided to stay. And she had a boyfriend who was living on a kibbutz. She was living with him. But we got some interesting perspectives on modern-day state of Israel from her. One of the things that she said was that it was much more valuable to know English than Hebrew. So, I mean, you should know Hebrew too, but if you had to have one or the other, it was better to know English than Hebrew. This is Sepphoris. Sepphoris is an interesting city in Galilee. It's just a few miles from Nazareth. It's been dug out in the last 10-15 years, I guess. There's a book by Richard Beatty, Jesus and the Forgotten City is the name of it, which talks about Sepphoris. And Sepphoris was the capital of Galilee before Herod Antipas built Tiberias, and it was very much a Greek Roman city, even though it was right there in the middle of the land of Palestine. It was very much a Greek Roman city, and Richard Beatty in his book, this is the theater there in Sepphoris. Richard Beatty in his book suggests that Jesus and his father might have even had a hand in some of the construction of Sepphoris, because it was only a matter of a few miles from the city of Nazareth. We often think of Jesus as growing up only surrounded by a rural area, very peasant stock. But if Beatty is correct, and not everybody agrees with him, in terms of the dating of the of how much of this city was built in Jesus' day. But if Beatty is correct, then there was quite a cosmopolitan city only a few miles from Nazareth. That structure that you see on top, that building, dates from the Crusader period. Inside, in one of the places they dug out in Sepphoris, they see this floor, this mosaic, which dates from the Roman period, sometime before Constantine, probably, or shortly after Constantine. It would have been a magnificent house, because this mosaic on the floor is quite extensive. This is Nazareth. The church that you see in the middle of the picture is the Church of the Annunciation. It again, I believe, is a Franciscan church. And this is the place where the angel Gabriel came to Mary, where they commemorate that. And again, this church was built, I believe, since 1960. Nazareth has been traditionally a center of Palestinian Christianity. It has been one of the cities in the land of Israel, and Nazareth is not on the West Bank. It's in the land of Israel that they had after 1948 and before 1967. It's a Palestinian Christian city, or has been. There's the church. It's quite a beautiful building inside. This is Megiddo. Have you ever heard of Megiddo? You know the name Armageddon? Armageddon is the mount or the hill of Megiddo. And Megiddo, it was a fortress of Solomon. King Ahab built it up quite a bit, did a lot of the work. There's a tunnel there that was used to bring water into the city. That is quite a fancy tunnel, and it was built by Ahab. Megiddo stands at the western end of the Jezreel Valley. And if you go from Egypt up to Damascus, if you go from Egypt, North Africa, trying to get up to Asia Minor and into Europe, the easiest way to go, or one of the easiest ways to go, is to go up the coast of Israel and cross the Jezreel Valley and then up the other side of the Sea of Galilee, the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. So the Jezreel Valley was a place where many battles have been fought over the centuries among competing and warring empires, particularly empires based in Damascus, Syria, and based in Cairo and that area in Egypt. Palestine has been a central battleground for lots of empires. And of course, Armageddon, this side is traditionally seen, according to some interpretation of the book of Revelation, as the fight of the last battle, place of the last battle. And that's looking out over the Jezreel Valley from Megiddo. The Jezreel Valley today in Israel is a quite a rich agricultural area. Israel, as far as I can tell, their biggest way of making money is tourism and is agriculture. Israel exports fruits and vegetables to Europe. They grow so much, they developed it to such a science in terms of how to conserve their water. But the Jezreel Valley is one place that is part of their agricultural breadbasket. This is in Megiddo, going down to this tunnel that brought water into the city. And that's the inside of that tunnel. Of course, they didn't have lights back in Ahab's day. But one of the interesting things about how they built this tunnel is they would take a piece of wood and put it in a crevice in the rock and wet it. The wood would expand, crack the rock a little bit and then they chip it out. And that's how they built that entire tunnel, they say.
How long is it?
I'd have to look that up. I don't remember. It's not all that long.
City blocks
or? Oh yeah, it's at least a couple city blocks. This is looking out over Haifa. Haifa is not mentioned in the Bible because it wasn't there in the Bible, biblical times. Haifa is at the end of Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is really kind of a range. It's not a single mountain like we think of a mountain like Buckskin Mountain or something like that. It's more of kind of a plateau range. But Israel, the three largest cities in Israel today are Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Jerusalem. This is going down the coast from Haifa. This is a Roman aqueduct by Caesarea. They brought water up down from the north down to the city of Caesarea through this Roman aqueduct. One of the way that they built this aqueduct, they say, these arches, is they would make the earth into a large mound, and then they would put the stones and the mortar and let it set, and then they would dig out the mound of earth. And so that's how the arch was constructed. This is the Mediterranean Ocean. This aqueduct dates from the Roman times. It wasn't always exposed like this. One of the reasons it's been able to be preserved and we have it is it was under sand for many, many years. This is in Caesarea. This is the theater in Caesarea. This is a theater that, although it's had some modern work done on it, dates back, they say, to the first century. To Caesarea was a city. The Caesarea on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea was a city that was built by Herod the Great. And if you remember in Acts, when Paul was brought before Felix and those folks, he probably was brought before them here at the theater in Caesarea. When you sit in those seats and look out, you look out at the Mediterranean Sea. It's quite an impressive sight. Caesarea was built by Herod the Great, and if you're into reading National Geographic, there is an issue a few years ago, I'm not sure how many years ago now, within the last 10 years, there's an issue of National Geographic that describes the building of Caesarea by Herod the Great. So you could probably look that up and find it if you're interested.
Why would Paul be trying to be in place?
Remember when he was about to be stoned by the Jews in Jerusalem and he appealed to Caesar and he was brought up to Caesarea and he spent some time there, you know, in jail before he finally got his trip to Rome? So if you read in later chapters of the book of Acts, you could read about that. This is part of Caesarea, and some of these structures you see are these buildings are from the Crusader time. Caesarea was rebuilt in part by the Crusaders. It was the port of entry where they entered the land sailing from Europe and to go to Jerusalem. This, I've never been able to figure it out, but this stone, they say, has the name of Pontius Pilate. And it is an evidence of Pontius Pilate's existence in Palestine. Caesarea, during the time of Jesus, during the time of Pontius Pilate, Caesarea is where the Roman procreator had his had his seat of government.
You want me to show you where it is? His name?
Okay.
P-I-L-A-T-U-S. Pilatus, and this is the last part of Pontius, I-U-S. You see it?
Yeah.
U-S-P-I-L-A-T-U-S.
All right. Now I know that for future reference.
Sure.
It helps to have a scholar in residence. Now, on the other side of the land, about 70 miles inland, on the, near the Jordan River, is another city that is one of the most impressive sites in ancient Israel. This is the city of Beth Shean. Now, do you see that mountain in the background? That's called a tell. And until this century, what we see in the foreground was all covered up by dirt, the dirt of centuries. But this is the city of Beth Shean, which had a different name in Jesus' day. It was one of the 10 cities of the Decapolis. I think it was the only city, or maybe one of two cities, that was on the western side of the Jordan River. It's an ancient city. It was the city where King Saul and his son Jonathan, when they were killed, their bodies were put on the walls of this city, and they were then taken down by one of the tribes of Israel. But this city was a thriving city in Jesus' day, and it's quite a remarkable structure. You can see the remains of it from Roman times. But it's interesting to note that Jesus would have passed by this city coming down from Galilee to Jericho and up to Jerusalem if he was coming down the Jordan River way. That mound of dirt that was in the other picture? This is up on top of that mound of dirt, looking back over the city. You see that main road is how the Romans built a main thoroughfare through the middle of the city. There are columns on either side. And in the distance, you see another theater, Roman theater.
What year was this?
January of 84? Yeah, January of 84. 94. 94. Yeah, I was there in January, and of all the archaeological sites, the only places that they were actively doing work when I was there were Sepphoris and here. You see, they're trying to. That's at the theater, one of the arches as an entrance to the theater. They're trying to fix that up. Qumran. Have you heard of Qumran? You've heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? There is where, I forget which one of those caves is where the first scrolls were found. It's probably the one right in the middle. This is the remains of the community of the Qumran, where the Essenes, where they say the Essenes were. As most things are in ancient Israel, all this is debated by scholars. But that's where they say the Essenes lived. And then this is further down from Qumran. That's the Dead Sea in the distance, and this is a tram that takes you up to Masada. And I forget whether that's Qumran or that's Masada. Where you're going down into where you wash yourself. That isn't me, but that's somebody floating in the Dead Sea. They say that if you drink a cup of water from the Dead Sea, it would kill a human being because of all the salt and mineral content, I guess. But you really can float like that. One of the things in the modern industry of the Jews is to is they make this mud out of the Dead Sea, and it's supposed to make your skin more tender or something like that. I didn't try it myself, but some of the women and men too in our party tried it, put it on, and they did say, I felt her skin after she washed off, and it did feel pretty smooth, but I don't know how much that had to do with the mud. No, I didn't feel it prior.
You didn't tell your wife.
No, she wasn't my wife. Her husband was along on the trip.
And that's what they all said.
This is Jericho. And that's looking out at the dig or the tell of Jericho. That's an old photograph. Jericho is an oasis. It is one of the oldest continuously occupied cities, by some accounts, in the world. That's looking at modern day Jericho from the dig site. See this this wall down in the bottom middle of the picture? This kind of roundish wall, they say, dates back to 7,000 B.C. That wall right there dates to 7,000 B.C., they say. The Jericho and this area, the Dead Sea, is the lowest point of dry land on Earth. And it can get pretty hot there. I was in January. Was there in January, and it was hot, and I guess it's pretty hot in the summer. But Jericho is an interesting city when you read about the archaeology of it. There is a lot of dispute over whether or not they can find any walls that actually came tumbling down, as in the story of Joshua. But they have found a lot there. I don't know if they're still doing a dig there. I didn't see any evidences that they were actively still doing a dig there. But this is a sycamore tree in Jericho. Now, I won't tell you that this is the one Zacchaeus climbed, but it is of the type, I would guess, that Zacchaeus climbed. We stopped by this tree, and John Peterson, the program director here, got off the bus and wanted to take a picture of it, and he did. But he also had these little Palestinian children that were there, and they sort of wanted to get in the picture, so he took their picture, and then they asked for a dollar from him. So it cost. He had to cough up some money for his picture. There is right by. It's a big tourist area right by this dig, and you can ride a camel if you want. I didn't try it myself, but I told a few of you that the Palestinians were getting into the act in terms of taking advantage of tourists. This is right across from the entrance to the archaeological dig, which is a national park site of Jericho. And this is the Last Temptation of Christ restaurant and hotel that they were building to take advantage of the tourists.
Well, that's new.
So I don't know if it's completed yet or not. Well, they were building that to take advantage. Okay, that shows you how much, how many shekels it takes to get into the Herodium.
What's a shekel in real money?
When I was there, I think it was 3 shekels to a dollar. This is what is called the Herodian. The Herodian is a hill and a palace inside that hill that Herod the Great had built as one of a number of places that he had built for him and his family in case he wanted to get out of town or go relax in the country or something. And it is a little bit southeast of Bethlehem. When I was in Israel, one of the guides that we had wouldn't take us there, and then I stayed a few extra days and we got another guide who would take us there. But that is, I believe there are 5 or 7 stories of this palace in that hill. In the foreground, you see what looks like a gigantic swimming pool. It is. It was built by Herod the Great, and he used to drown folks he didn't like there, like even his children and his wife. From the top of that hill, the Herodian looking down into it.
You mean it's sort of like a volcano?
Well, it's a man-made hill, they say.
Open in the middle.
Open in the middle.
Uh-huh.
This is supposed to be the place where Herod the Great was buried, although they haven't yet found evidence of his burial there. That's the refrigerator. This is looking out over the Judean hills. You see how desolate it is. Do you see? This is the Wadi Kelt, and you see. There's a building. There's a monastery there. Yeah, thanks, Bill. Okay. The Wadi Kelt is the road that went from along this deep ravine, this cut out by water. There was a aqueduct that went from up by Jerusalem down towards Jericho. But this is the road that you went from Jericho up to Jerusalem along this wadi. There's a much more modern road now, built, they tell me, by U.S. tax dollars. But in Jesus' day, this would have been the road to take.
Why is a river?
This I thought was interesting up there in the hills between Jericho and Jerusalem. This is evidence of some of one of the wars. We also found one of the Israeli bunkers. We didn't see any soldiers at that bunker, but we also didn't decide to wander through it. That's, again, lots of cacti there. There's a camel. This was at the Good Samaritan Inn on the way between Jericho and Jerusalem. This camel, by the way, spit at one of the young women in our party. You got to watch out for those camels. The city of Jerusalem, looking out from the Mount of Olives. That's the Dome of the Rock in the middle. And the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the left-hand side of the screen. That's what they call the Temple Mount area there. Right below the walls of Jerusalem are where Christians and Muslims are buried. That's at night, the walls of Jerusalem. Remember, they were built by Suleiman the Magnificent. This is the Damascus Gate into the city of Jerusalem, which enters the Muslim quarter today. To me, one of the most fascinating stops in my journey was being on top of that gate on that wall there and looking down at the market goings on underneath. Of course, again, this is not the exact same wall and gate that was there in Jesus' day, but